Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. I'm speaking to you from Dublin, from the Merrion Hotel, where I am sitting with John Banville and several visiting members associated with the Lannan Foundation. We've come to Dublin for the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the day on which Ulysses takes place, not the 100th anniversary of its publication. I assume that's yet to come. There'll be another big deal. John Banville brought to give one of the addresses to the James Joyce Symposium began by acknowledging that his own work is not work that takes on the encyclopedic world participant of the Joycean frame, but rather of the unaccommodating world, the world which is in tandem with one's temptation to withdraw from it. In fact, it's hard to say which came first, the alienation or the hostility from the world in response to the alienation. So I thought I'd begin by asking you to, in a sense, recap what's been your position, that the Bloomsday has been more a social than a literary function.
Well, I mean, who could disapprove of a party? I mean, it's been a big party, and it's been, I hope, enjoyable for people. I envy these people who have the nerve to dress up in straw boaters and blazers and silk dresses and go out about the streets. They look very elegant, and they look as if they're having a wonderful time. My problem, I suppose, is that I am suspicious when tourist boards and political parties and government ministers suddenly get very interested in literature. I become very suspicious indeed. And I also feel about the whole Bloomsday Festival, while not wishing to rain on anybody's party, that it is wrong to try to deceive people into believing that art is easy. Art is not. Ulysses is a wonderful book, a wonderfully entertaining book, one of the funniest books ever written in places. But it is not easy. You would need a dictionary. You'd need many other reference books beside you as you read it. It is wonderfully entertaining, as I say, but you have to work for that entertainment. And as I say, I think it is wrong to try to deceive people into thinking otherwise. But then, most people haven't read Ulysses. Even the people who think they've read Ulysses, for the most part, haven't read Ulysses.
Oh, well, in America, it rather shocked me. I was part of a symposium when it was named the most important novel published in the century, and most of the guest speakers and intellectuals said, oh, I've never finished it. I said, weren't you at least curious to? I mean, you know, the novel that is said to have done everything the novel was able to do up to its point and then extended its parameters some 30 years with its publication. Wouldn't you want to just find out about it as a professional? They seemed rather indifferent by now. The ambitious novel is something of a thing of the past, at least in America.
Well, I mean, we could tease this one out for the rest of the night. I am not sure that Ulysses is a novel in the sense in which George Eliot or even Henry James would have understood a novel. I don't think it does those things that those novels did. I think it is an extraordinarily innovative hybrid, but it is a hybrid. There are also at least two works, I wouldn't even say novels, there are two works within the covers of that book. There is the novel that Joyce started to write when he was isolated in Trieste, when he was a youngish man. By the time he got to Paris and became part of that Parisian modernist scene, he realized that he had to, in Ezra Pound's memorable deadening phrase, make it new. I think that, and many people will disagree with this, many people will be horrified, I think that in Ulysses there is lost the great summation, the great final statement of the Victorian novel, but I think it's lost in Ulysses. And I think that the experimentation that he went into in the latter two-thirds of the book are in ways disastrous.
I'm speaking to John Banville, and really my occasion here is that I'm speaking to one of the two or three central living Irish novelists. In fact, after Bloomsday, I've been rereading Shroud, and I'm under a whole different shadow as a result. And it's been seeming to me that the book does pit some of these questions rather terrifyingly against one another, the question of politics on the one hand and of aestheticism on the other. We've got a man who is not a whole man. He has lived two parts of his life. He's apparently had several selves and has gone from being a victim to a bullying aesthete. And his consciousness and his avoidance of consciousness create mirrors and shadows. It's one of those books that seem to want to attack identity itself. The narrator, seeing himself in a mirror, feels that the mirror is sipping a bit out of him. When he leaves a chair, he feels he leaves a bit of himself behind. And by the time you've gotten to the midway point of the book, I think the reader feels destabilized in a significant way. Can you talk about that? Is that an intentional strategy?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think, to make a segue from a previous part of our conversation, I think Joyce would have absolutely hated this book because it would have seemed to him much too much concerned with questions of identity. Joyce really didn't have any problems with that. Joyce was a medievalist almost in his sense of there being an absolute, which is the self. There is a James Joyce, there is a John Banville, and these are inalienable identities. I don't feel that. I don't feel, when I look inside myself, I don't find a John Banville. I'm speaking as an artist, not as a man. There are always two people speaking here. My protagonist in Shroud, I was going to say hero, my protagonist in Shroud is a man who has given up what was his original identity in favor of a second one for no real reason. I mean, he adduces reasons for it, but there is no, when you look at the book closely, there is no reason for him to have given up being who he was in order to be somebody else. Being somebody else has actually presented him with more difficulties than if he'd retained his original identity. And I suppose at a certain level the book is addressing the question of whether there is a self or not. I increasingly come to the conclusion that there is no self, that there is an infinite succession of selves.
John Banville has written, I'm going to name them, many previous novels. Among the novels are Eclipse, The Untouchable, Athena, I'm going in reverse, Ghosts, The Book of Evidence, Mephisto, The Newton Letter, Kepler, Dr. Copernicus, and the most recent of the books have been being published in hardcover by Knopf and in paperback, like Shroud, by Vintage. Now, objects following the loss of identity start to speak and stutter and mumble. A trunk comes back to the apartment and talks to itself, ashamed to have been lost. And there's a refrigerator which, after turning off, becomes noticeable as having been speaking to itself. The revolt of objects, I think, is the phrase that Nathaniel West uses for this. Do they become competitors with the human?
I like that. I never knew that phrase, revolt of objects, yes. Well, if you were to classify my writing, it is post-humanist. Mm-hmm. It does not regard human beings as the center of the universe. This seems to me a hangover from our good old religious days. So many of our seemingly secular ideas are in fact just spilt religion. I don't think human beings are the center of the universe. I think that we are, well, I never like to say this, but I believe it. I think we are simply the most successful virus that this world has ever known. And I suspect that bigger and better viruses will do us in the end. The world would probably be a better place without us. But that great, beautiful, tender, delicate experiment that we were will have been marvelous. I would like to think there will be people on Cygnus X3 or somewhere who will be able to remember what we did. But I don't think that we are as important as we think we are. And people constantly, to come down from those great heights, people constantly say to me, you know, I tried to read that bloody book of yours, but I kept saying, why can't he just tell us a story? Why is he telling us about the weather and the stones in the road and what the clouds look like? And I say, but this is where we live. This is how we live. We don't live as ourselves. We live ourselves within the world.
And yet, at the same time, we're living in the wake of Beckett, right? He told us and he told us that, you know, what there is a tree and a couple of tramps at the side of the road and arguments about things whose resolution don't matter very much and identities that turn into mirror identities and even those polarized don't remain unique. So in a certain sense, this becomes part of the post-Joyce project. I think Beckett turns away from Joyce and says the inner world and its absolute loss of presence in the outer universe. This is the subject in the wake of that busy, buzzing place that Joyce wrote about. What about the inner darkness and absence and loss? And what about a world in which these things don't give way? What if the external world were just a digression from the ongoing symphony of spirit? But it seems to me that you are a step past that, because Beckett seems to have lived a solitary life. When I was reading Shroud, I said, the division in this book is a man who is presenting the isolated self, but the author writes a weekly column for a newspaper, so that there is the terrible need to transgress against the solitary self, almost to speak against him publicly.
No, I think you're being too deterministic. art doesn't progress in the way that we would like to think that it does. There is not Joyce and then Beckett and then me and then whoever. You know, I shouldn't even put myself in that progression. But while Joyce and Beckett were working, there was Yeats, and Yeats was completely anti-modernist, was working in a completely different rhetorical mode, which is just as valid as Joyce's or Beckett's. They both had nothing but respect for him. And I might say that while a couple of days before the Bloomsday celebrations, poor old Yeats's birthday was not celebrated. Nobody takes any notice of that, but that's an aside. it's very difficult to... It depends how deeply you want to go into the sources of art and the functions of art. Beckett is not really talking about life. Beckett is talking about art. For Beckett said famously of Joyce's work that Joyce's work is not about something, it is a thing itself. That actually isn't true. It's true to some extent of Finnegan's Wake, certainly not of Ulysses. But Beckett took that, he heard himself say that, and he went on to try to make an art that would be entirely autonomous, self-contained, that would not have reference to the world as we know the world. He reduced everything to a few props, even in the fiction, you know, a bicycle, a bowler hat, a crutch, whatever. He was trying to get as close to a non-human art as he possibly could. He very nearly got there in the 70s, but it turned out to be completely arid. And it's very fascinating to watch Beckett leaving that aridity behind and moving into an extraordinarily humane art in his last works, such as Ill Seen, Ill Said, or Company, which are almost sentimental in their attitudes to the world. So I'm simply... This is a roundabout way of saying that we shouldn't be too deterministic about the ways in which art works. There is not a progression. Every artist works as he can. We do what we do.
In your book, toward the end of the first section, one character turns out to be epileptic, while another, with one eye and one bad leg, they're trying to prop each other up. They keep on falling down. They're exchanging. Each gets wounded similarly, one in the shoulder in the morning, the other in the shoulder in the afternoon. The book turns into a symmetry of mutilations and a comedy of unfunctioning limbs. This gives a certain kind of person pleasure, because it seems at least to be mildly comic, to be less catastrophic than a concentration camp. But if you see the world as tending toward the great demolition derby, then novels of these sorts almost feel like holidays from the massive destruction.
Well, of course, that's for you to say and not for me. I, again, would want to insist that your listeners and my readers keep constantly in mind that this is not, these works are not about me or not about them. They're not grand statements of either a philosophical or a sociological nature. They're simply, you see, at a certain level, all works of art are simply the result of trying to solve a technical problem. How do you have, something comes into your head, right? And you think, how do I get this expressed? It's not an idea, it's not a philosophy, it's you simply want to express something about the world, and about how odd a place the world is, right? How strange it is. For Joyce, this wasn't the case. Joyce simply wanted to say, this is how it is. For writers like Kleist and Kafka and me, again, I shouldn't be putting myself in this progression, we're constantly expressing amazement. Look at this extraordinary world. Look at these people. You know? Okay. I'm one of them. This is an amazing phenomenon. I cannot get used to it. And when I make a work of art, what I'm expressing there is my bafflement. But this takes the form of a technical problem. And this is true for any artist, Joyce or Beckett or Kafka, or anybody else. How does one get this done? Because in a way, all works of art for the artist are finished. Once they've started, they're finished. All one has to do is get the thing written or painted or composed. You know, I always remember, I was trying to write books about science, I mean fictions about science. I remember coming across a thing that Einstein said. I can't quoted, but he expresses amazement at the fact that the world obeys rules which we made up. Mathematics is not a natural phenomenon. Most people seem to think it is. Mathematics is a man-made science, man-made discipline. But the world obeys those rules. He became very suspicious of this, and he said, I suspect that we only see that part of reality that our rules can encompass. I think the same is true of art, that we make art that will fit the amount of the world that we can see.
The language is very beautiful, and its cadences, often, as they say, autumnal. There's an ongoing gravity of statement. Now, I would say, for some strange reason, this phrase-by-phrase sound of the consciousness inventing itself in phrase after phrase. We find it in Kafka's Mole. We find it in Beckett's Unnameable. We find it in Thomas Bernhardt. We find it in even in Kleist, although he doesn't really have first-person narratives. It's that sense of the world coming to life phrase by phrase, the phrases known for their balance, for their sadness. What is the role of the beauty of language, or the calm of language, the consolation, I guess I would say, of language?
Well, people, including myself, laugh at Yeats for his obsession late in life when he did his greatest work with sex and the sexual drive. I feel more and more that doing art is sort of like doing sex. That this would seem ridiculous and frivolous, but there's a kind of concentration in art, in the making of art, that waxes and wanes in the same way that sexuality waxes and wanes. There's a kind of pressure on the material. You know, you sit down in the morning and you, in the same way that you get in bed with a partner, and you sort of fiddle about, and you don't quite know what you're doing, and you're not sure you should be here, and you're not sure what the material is, and you work away, and after a while you realize that you're completely lost, that you have been swept away into the material, and that the material has been swept away into you. And that's when you do this. That's when the material, that's when the best work is done. That's when the only work is done. And I mean this in the broadest sense. I mean, I'm not talking about sexual intercourse, but the whole, our sexual selves, it seems to me, in the same way that our dreaming selves are very like, to me anyway, they're very like the self out of which I work.
The narrator speaks of the infrequency with which he ever gave his wife, Magda, gifts. He remembers that after he had perceived that she'd lost her mind, that he buys her a vase. It's glass. There's a white sugary spiral working up the glass. He doesn't like it very much. It seems to turn green, and it's inside snot-like to him within days of its arrival. But he thinks his wife might like it, but she has no way of communicating that. And then one day, this vase falls in two. There's a sound like a gunshot, and he finds the vase in two neat pieces. Now, a reader, bearing in mind that there is something of a detective named Cleve, wants to make this vase symbolic of the divided self, of having, of all kinds of things, but it obdurately refuses, actually, to make coherent sense. And it seemed to me in that way, finally, a model for the way this novel works.
I'm afraid it's just hideously banal. I stole that image and incident from a friend of mine who was having a very intense love affair. And on the day that the affair broke up, he was sort of lying on his couch trying to deal with this. And this vase that this lover had given him cracked in exactly that way. Every now and then one takes a little bit of bleeding life and thrusts it into the work. Who knows? It may be, I had never thought before you said it that this might be symbolic of the riven self. So let it stand as a symbol of the riven self. That's fine by me.
You'd never thought it, even though you have a character named Cleve.
No, I'd never thought of that. No.
Who's dividing her subject between his past and his present?
But look, you know, this is what I meant when I said that art is more like dreaming than like doing science or philosophy. I remember when The Untouchable was published, throughout the book, the character is fighting with himself as to whether it's better to think or to feel, whether it's better to live or to live in the world of ideas. At the end of it, he's about to shoot himself, and he says, there's a line, it's almost the last line in the book, where he says something like, through the head or in the head or through the heart, now there's a dilemma. Lots of people said to me how wonderfully I had caught the whole essence of the book in this one line. That never occurred to me. Never occurred to me. Right? Somebody else did that. When you sit down to write, there is always somebody else sitting there. Some other presence that knows more than I do and that does these things. There is a kind of instinct, just in the way that when we dream about the most amazing things that we thought we knew nothing about until the dreamer dreamt it for us. It's the same with art.
I've been speaking to John Banville, the author most recently of The Shroud, which has recently been published in paperback by Vintage. We're speaking from a hotel room in Dublin with a couple of other visitors to the James Joyce Centenary. Thank you, John Banville, for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The editor is Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Come back next week for Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.